This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. You could be forgiven for believing that the books of the Bible were written by the men whose names are on them. Why would a book that is called the Gospel of John, for example, be written by someone named Jedediah? But scholars have long understood that the Gospels most likely were not written by those whose names are attached. In the ancient world, authors often attributed their writings to others in hopes of honoring the teacher or perhaps lending credibility to their assertions. But Bart Ehrman has come to a different understanding. He argues in his new book, Forged, that deceiving people in writing was no more acceptable in antiquity than it is today. Ehrman is chair of the Religious Studies Department at UNC Chapel Hill. He's written more than 20 books related to New Testament studies. Among them are bestsellers Misquoting Jesus, God's Problem, and Jesus Interrupted. Also a frequent guest on our program, Bart Ehrman. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
As we said in the intro, most academics think that it was a widespread practice for the ancients to attribute to their teachers. You have looked at this idea, found it is not true. Let me ask you the other one. Why do you think scholars believe this in the first place?
Well, I used to believe it myself. I used to teach it to my undergraduates, and the reason I believed it was because that's what I read in all the books that I referred to, and the authors of those books read it in other books, and the authors of those books read it in other books. And so what's happened is the scholars have been saying this for generations, and nobody's bothered to look at the actual evidence from the ancient world, or very few people have. And it turns out the evidence is extremely sparse that this ever happened.
What kind of evidence do you have? Is it a lack of evidence for the acceptance of this kind of forgery, or evidence to the contrary, that it was not accepted at all?
We have lots of evidence of forgery happening where people would where somebody would write a book claiming to be someone else. That happened a lot. What we don't have are ancient discussions that approve the practice. We have a lot of discussions that disapprove the practice and condemn it as lying and deceitful. What we don't have are, for example, philosophers saying that it was okay to do this as long as you were repeating some of the ideas of your teacher.
So when was this done? You say that there is evidence of forgery. Who did it and why?
Well, it was done a lot. In researching my book, I spent a couple of years reading nothing but Greek and Latin sources on people talking about forgery, and it turns out they talk about it a lot. It goes back to as far back as we have authors naming themselves as authors of books. Nearly that early, we have people claiming to be those authors naming books.
So this practice is not approved. Bring us forward now. 2,000 years ago, narratives about the life of Jesus start to be written. We do know that the authors weren't those who they weren't the apostles Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We still not even clear which John we're talking about in John, I think. Why has the church accepted this for so long, the idea that authorship wasn't necessarily attributed to the apostles themselves?
Yes, it's a really interesting question. And with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we're in a little bit different situation than we are with some of the other books of the New Testament, because whoever wrote Matthew doesn't claim to be Matthew. He just wrote a book anonymously, and later church father said, oh yes, that was Matthew. And so this is what I would call a false attribution, and it's not the author's fault. It's somewhat different with something like the book of Ephesians, which is a book that claims to be written by Paul, even though the author was not Paul. And so that's the sort of thing that I would call a forgery.
And in that case, we're not talking about narratives. We're not talking about the story of someone else's life. These are letters. There should be documents. Isn't it easy to prove who wrote the letter and who didn't?
Well, it's not easy to prove, but modern scholars think they can prove. With Ephesians, for example, we do have seven letters. In the New Testament, there are 13 letters that claim to be written by Paul, and seven of them scholars are pretty sure Paul really wrote. And so when you have another letter like the letter of Ephesians, you can compare it with the other seven and see, does it have the same kind of vocabulary, the same kind of writing style, the same theology? Does it presuppose the same historical situation, or are all these things different? And if they're different, then you might suspect that, in fact, somebody else wrote the letter.
And there's been controversy about Paul's writing for a long time. As you say, Ephesians, Colossians, suggestions that maybe Paul didn't write them all.
That's right. There are very strong arguments, and I do some of these arguments in my book, because even though this is widely known among scholars, it's not widely known among lay readers of the Bible.
Does it make a difference who wrote the story once or the letters once they're established as the canon, as part of the official teaching?
Well, on one level, it might not matter. It would be like if somebody wrote a treatise on physics and claimed to be Einstein. The physics would be true or false depending on the scientific principles, not based on the authorship. And with the New Testament, you have authors claiming to be Paul when they weren't Paul. Does that affect things? On one level, it does affect things, though, because the book of Ephesians says that Jesus is the truth, and it says that believers in their spiritual warfare should put on the belt of truth, and it says they should speak the truth to one another, and yet the author lied about who he was. And so if nothing else, it's ironic.
Why do you suppose in that case in particular, the author decided not to reveal who he was and take on Paul's persona?
My guess is that the author had a message that he thought was really important. He was somebody who was not well known. He wanted people to accept his message. And so rather than writing in his own name, he claimed to be Paul on the assumption that people then would read his book. And so he was willing to lie about his identity in order to get his message across.
Is there any suggestion that everybody at the time knew that this was a forgery? We all know Paul. He was here. That's why he's writing back to us.
Yes, that's another view that scholars have thrown about and assumed was the case that I looked into. And it doesn't appear that that was the case. Everybody seems to have thought this letter really was written by Paul. So whoever did this appeared on one level, he had to convince people that he really was Paul. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. In other words, if the reason for writing this is so people will read it because it's written by Paul, if they knew it wasn't Paul, then you'd be self-defeating. And so the author appears to have wanted to deceive his audience. And from what we can tell, he was spectacularly successful.
Well, there's even another letter of Paul that warns readers not to be fooled by false prophets and false teachers.
Well, yeah. 2 Thessalonians goes even farther. 2 Thessalonians warns its readers against a letter that is forged in the name of Paul. But 2 Thessalonians probably is a letter forged in the name of Paul. And so you ask, well, why would a forger warn against forgeries? It's precisely because then his readers don't suspect him of doing what he's condemning.
That's an old trick, and it's been brought forward in modern times, to be sure. Do you feel that it's important to is scholarship now better? Were the ancients and then the church fathers fooled just because they didn't have the tools we have?
Well, a lot of them were because they don't have the tools we have. Most readers in the ancient world, of course, were illiterate altogether and weren't able to do any kind of literary analysis. There were church fathers, though, who debated these issues. For example, the book of 2 Peter, there were scholars in the early church up through the 4th century who said, Peter absolutely did not write this book, and so it should not be part of the New Testament. As it turns out, they were right about that, but they lost the argument, and 2 Peter got put in.
Yeah, and there's a pretty good hint that as a fisherman in ancient Galilee, he probably wasn't literate at all.
Yeah, I argue in my book that, in fact, he couldn't write. And that isn't a novel finding. I mean, the book of Acts in chapter 4 says that Peter was illiterate, and I think he absolutely was. So what scholars have tried to say over the years is maybe Peter dictated the letter to someone else, and then so someone else wrote it down. And I try to show in my book why, in fact, we don't have any analogy for that kind of thing in the ancient world.
You know, you made the distinction and you made the analogy between this and physics. If I wrote good physics in the name of someone who I wasn't, if the physics hold up, so what? How important and why was it so important for the church to establish authorship as a form of credibility for teachings that should be able to stand on their own?
Right. It was a huge issue for the early Christians. The problem was there are so many different points of view floating around with different authors claiming different things that somebody has to decide, well, what's the right thing to believe? And to know that, you have to know which books can you trust. And they decided early on that if a book was not written by an apostle, it can't be trusted. I mean, it might be a good book, might be a great book, but we're not going to have it as scripture. And so in order for a book to be accepted as part of the New Testament, it had to have an apostolic name attached to it. That's why the Gospels, which are originally anonymous, had Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John attached to them so that people would see that these were authoritative texts.
So here's the church making an effort to establish a canon of texts that are going to establish the teaching and doctrine of the church. Here's what we believe. Anything outside this, we don't believe. Then you have these Gospels, as you say, originally anonymous, and they have this scandalous from some points of view, the four different endings for the risen Christ. Easter Sunday is described four very different and in conflicting ways. Why didn't the same church fathers decide to get that story straight before they put it in the canon?
Right. Well, they had long debates about just that issue, and different church fathers had different approaches to it. The problem was that by the time the church fathers were deciding which books were going to be in the canon, these four books were so widely circulated and so widely popular that church fathers couldn't very well say, well, we're not going to include this, because everybody was including it. And so they had other solutions. There was one famous theologian, for example, who took all four gospels and smashed them together into one big gospel, and thereby reconciling all the differences. So the church fathers recognized that this was a problem, and they had different ways of dealing with it.
Is there anything about this? You teach this now, and you have been teaching this for a while to new crops of incoming freshmen. Are they surprised each year to see that not everything in the gospel is exactly, well, gospel?
Yes. Every year my students seem to be surprised. And I've taught at Chapel Hill now for 22 years, and I keep wondering, why don't they get it yet? Then I realize, oh, this is a new group. Yeah. I should point out that that teaching these things is not unusual. This kind of information that we're talking about now is common knowledge among New Testament scholars. And so it's not just the crazy radical views of a liberal who teaches at Chapel Hill, although it is that, but it's not only that. But this is common knowledge. What's different in this book of mine is that I come out and say that, in fact, we should call a spade a spade. This would be called forgery in the modern world, and in the ancient world, they said negative things about it as well.
How were the discussions among those theologians who were able to read and, as you said, did discuss and notice the discrepancies? Were they more open to the possibilities that this offered, or more rigid and kind of fundamental in their understanding of interpretation?
They're a little bit more fundamental. I mean, when a church father came to the decision that a book was forged, his automatic response was to say that we can't include it in the Bible. It's lying and it's deceptive, and so they took a fairly hard line on it.
You make a distinction between this kind of thing. I mean, you know, we all sort of live with myth in our political life. George Washington and the cherry tree, right? This is a story that's supposed to talk about the honesty of our founding father. Can't the church interpret its own teachings that way? I mean, isn't there? Don't we know that that didn't happen?
Yes, I think that more enlightened Christians do approach the Bible that way. That the Adam and Eve story isn't a literal description of the two first human beings, but that in some sense it's a metaphorical story that's functioning as a story, not as a history lesson or a science lesson. And the same thing would be true with the teachings of the New Testament. That one needs to be very careful if one wants to take everything precisely literally. For one thing, it leads to all sorts of problems. People using the New Testament for harmful and oppressive ways.
Was there a time in the history of Christianity when there was a more open view to interpreting the texts?
Well, you know, modern fundamentalists often say that if you don't believe in the Bible, you can't be a Christian. This is a view that you find in a lot of churches in the South. And what people don't realize is that this is a very modern invention, the idea that being a Christian involves believing in the Bible. If you look at the creeds of the church over history, none of the creeds, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creeds, none of the creeds has anything about having to believe in the Bible. This is a completely modern invention. And so I think people throughout the history of the church have taken a less stringent view of what the Bible needs to be.
Also, aren't we running afoul of these two different ideas about interpreting narrative? I mean, the idea of even writing histories, right? It's Herodotus, isn't he? The first sort of, we think of him as the Greek, kind of an outsider. He really wasn't born in Greece. He was born in a Greek province. So here's a guy, a colony, really. Who's looking at his ethnic background from the outside in. It's a whole new way of interpreting yourself and your story than that Middle Eastern storytelling tradition that really invites you to interpret and discuss this rather than haggle over the details.
Yes, well, that's right. And the Gospels that we have in the New Testament, of course, didn't originate as written documents by highly trained Greek-speaking professors. They started out as oral traditions being told in the Middle East, and these traditions got changed as the stories were told and retold. And so it's a mistake to treat these books as if they're a modern history book.
Bart, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bart Ehrman is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC. His latest book is called Forged. Bart Ehrman's going to speak about the book tomorrow morning, Saturday morning, 11 o'clock at McIntyre's Fine Books at Farrington Village. For more information about that event, go to farrington.com. Just ahead, German surf rock, Space Rangers, live on the State of Things.